Steve.
Hey, Emma.
What do you do when you really like something?
You know what I do, Emma? I talk to all my friends about it. What do you do?
That's a great idea, Steve. I even tell strangers on iTunes how much I rate and review it.
What a great idea. Hello. Welcome to the Zeitgeist Tapes. My name's Stephen Fielding.
And I'm Emma Bunnell.
And together we're going to discuss, in this month's episode, Reds, Warren Beatty's truly remarkable film about American leftists in the early part of the 20th century and their relationship with the Russian Revolution, which was first released in 1981 to great acclaim, was nominated for 12 Oscars. Warren Beatty, who co-wrote it, directed it, starred in it. He didn't do the theme tune. That was Stephen Sondheim. But basically, it was Warren Beatty's project. Warren Beatty being a great Hollywood liberal who co-wrote it in conjunction with Trevor Griffiths, a British Marxist playwright, who today may be less well-known, but at the time in the 1970s and the early 1980s was the quintessential radical playwright in Britain. And we thought it would be quite a good idea to look at Reds because of what's been going on recently about Russia, Putin, Corbyn, the left in general, and just think about what it says about how Hollywood has sort of depicted this sort of remarkable phase in America's history, but in world history, because the film is a kind of love story. I mean, that's the central element. That's the Hollywood element, a love story between John Reed, or he's called Jack all the way through the film, Jack Reed, who wrote probably the most famous book that you've never read, 10 Days That Shook the World. Have you read 10 Days? You've not read it.
I have read it.
Oh, you have read it?
Yeah.
You're the one. Which is a first-hand account of John Reed's experience during the early stages of the Russian Revolution in 1917, which, by all accounts, is a remarkable document. Emma, you've read it. I haven't.
It really puts you right at the heart of the action. But the problem with it, there are many, many, many factions within the Russian Revolution, and there's very little explanation in the book about who they are of. There's a glossary that you can go back to, but the understanding of the different factions and the different people involved is sort of taken as, well, read. sorry, I couldn't resist that. It's a dynamic book. It's very, very, because it literally does the 10 days that shook the world. You're right in the heart of the action. You're right at the centre of it all. So once you kind of get through the which are the Mensheviks, which are the Bolsheviks, etc. Bits, then and let that kind of wash over you a little, then it's a thrilling heart of the action and a real. I mean, it's not American journalism as American journalism has come to be known, i.e., very much kind of neutral observer, disinterested. Not uninterested, but disinterested. That's not where John Reed was coming from at all. He's very much an active participant in the revolution. He cares very passionately about what's happening in it. And that, again, comes through in the book, and as it does in the film.
Yeah, the film itself doesn't really overcomplicate things too much.
No, you don't get that. Well, you get some of the factionalism in the US, but not in the Russian Revolution.
Yes. So I wouldn't want to put you off letting our listener who may not have seen the film yet think it's a literal retelling of a complicated story, because it is at its heart a love story between Jack Reed, the committed idealistic leftist American journalist who meets sometime before the First World War, Louise Bryant, who is at that point She's married to an Oregon dentist, Portland dentist, which doesn't sound very promising. But she is a woman who is frustrated with the limitations of being a conventional bourgeois wife, and the film is partly about how she develops as an independent figure to become a journalist of note herself, and the conflicts between her and Reed, his politics may be very leftist, but he is somewhat of a chauvinist, at least initially. And it takes a long time for their relationship to reach a kind of an equal basis. So given that this is a film that, well, its origins are actually in the late 1960s, when Beatty decided he wanted to do a film about Jack Reed, the American communist, and there aren't many of those. Given its origins and when it was produced in the early 80s, and there weren't many films which had mainstream Hollywood films that had a feminist subtext, or even not even a subtext, an actual text, it's quite remarkable, really, in the way that relationship is depicted, I think, anyway, looking at it now from this distance.
It's, in some ways, it felt almost more progressive than a lot of films that we get now. Diane Keaton was fairly strong in her own beliefs. Diane Keaton playing Louise Bryant was very strong in her own beliefs. And uncompromising in a good way. She wasn't going to let Jack Reed screw her over and, fanny about and leave her behind all the time as if she were the little housewife. And she made that such a strong stance that she left him and went all the way to report from the front at World War One, and he had to go after her. There was a real sense there that she was a strong and independent woman with her own beliefs. She has a strong belief in free love. And has an affair with Eugene O'Neill that it doesn't feel like she's trying to hide at any point from from Jack Reed, although I think she does play down the emotionality of it slightly. But that may be a Hollywood need, a need for that kind of psychodrama. But yeah, she is an equal character to Jack in every way, not least the fact that towards the latter half of the film, she crosses Siberia on her own, which is an extraordinary thing for anyone to do, even in with modern transport, never mind with literally by foot, as she was doing it in the 1920s.
So the film is in part, and I guess this is how they try to sell it, at least ostensibly, it's a love story, a feminist love story, remarkably feminist given the time in which it was produced, I think. But it's also a kind of love story between a group of American radicals and communism and the Bolshevik Revolution. And I don't know if I'm being too glib. I'm always too glib in the sense that the film, and there's a spoiler coming. So if you don't want it to be an unfortunate experience, well, what you're listening to this podcast for, by the way. But right at the end, Jack Reed dies, thereby ending that love story. But also, there's questions about the love story between the more intellectual political love story between these American radicals, or at least some of them, and the Russian Revolution, because the Russian Revolution, I think it's shown in sympathetic but not uncritical terms. You know, you get Zinoviev, you get the Comintern being shown. I don't know how many Hollywood films ever have done that, but it shows the chaos of the whole of the experience, but also the emerging authoritarianism that is being imposed during the early years of the Russian Revolution, while Lenin rather than Stalin is in charge of things, and actually Jack Reed is kind of incarcerated. He becomes a prisoner. They won't let him leave when he goes to Moscow, and he has to escape to Finland, where he is actually incarcerated. So it's a really interesting mix of like the private emotional lives of these figures, as well as the public lives that they also had, and just intertwines them in a truly epic. I mean, when people say epic, you sometimes you think, what do they mean? But this is a long film, but it's not just, and it doesn't feel like a long film, actually. It's one of those films which you don't get them anymore, which has an intermission.
Yeah.
you used to get them all the time, like Lawrence of Arabia and films like Bridge Over the River Kwai, Intermission. So this has an intermission. So it is a very long film. But it's shot in kind of once you get to the Russian steppes and everything, it is shot in such a beautiful way as well. So you get everything. You get the whole Hollywood number on a film about communists, which is truly remarkable.
It's a clever film. It doesn't give you an unvarnished view of the revolution, but it also doesn't do the whole American evil empire, all Russians are bad stuff either. So you have characters that are allowed to be critical of the revolution whilst also being supportive of its aims and values. Mm. So Emma Goldman is a particularly good voice there. Emma Goldman is... was a Russian Jew living in New York, who then went back to Russia to take part in the revolution, but became disillusioned and became eventually an anarchist. And you know, she is the one who, she and Jack are living together in Russia, not living together as partners, but as friends. And she says to him, you know, she tempers his optimism. I think he's there to be the voice of the optimism of what the revolution could be, should be, but is partially not becoming. And she's like, no, look around you. They haven't delivered the bread. They haven't delivered the freedom. And I think that's quite an interesting way of sort of saying, showing both sides of that argument rather than simply making this a polemic on one side or the other. And again, you have these wonderful real life voices of people who were around at the time in the International Workers Union, in the leftist movement in early America. And some of them appear to be British. And they are fabulous because they're real.
Yes, that's something we haven't really drawn attention to, have we? That they're interspersed with the drama. And I can't speak for the validity of, you know, the representations of these different figures and everything, but interspersed with that drama are interviews with people that were there, like you say, and they speculate. I mean, to some extent, they're actually saying, well, I'm not sure this really happened, or well, this was the gossip. This is what people said. But you do get that visceral sense of these are witnesses to the times that are being represented, and it's done really well. I don't know what you think.
It's done beautifully, because they're lovely witnesses, because they're not just sort of, oh, here's the really important thing that happened when we walked down the steps of this and that and the other. Yet they have these bitchy little asides. My favourite one, having sat under a portrait of her for 2 years while working at the Fabians, was, oh, bitches Webb was awfully ignorant. I just thought that is so human. And that's what's so often missing from our examination of the left and communism and all this. That lovely human element that just makes all of this so much realer. While the sort of, even the romance in Reds is sometimes a bit highfalutin, you know, the Jack and Louise fall back in love over the Russian Revolution, and Louise and Eugene O'Neill, who she has the affair with, played brilliantly by Jack Nicholson and very vulnerably by Jack Nicholson, which is an interesting casting choice. And they, you know, again, that's a very sort of sunlit affair on, you know, this bourgeois place by the sea where they all go to summer, sort of the Hamptons of the time. And it's all pinpricked. It never lets itself get too idealistic or too pompous. It always sort of undercuts that slightly with a, well, yes, and. Rather than, no, you can't have that. It's more, yes, that's what we want, but there are human elements.
And there's humour. I mean, there is humour. I mean, I think Warren Beatty is probably one of the most underrated Hollywood figures of that time, and certainly as a political filmmaker, because he is Hollywood. I mean, you know, he has humor in what he does, and of course he's, you know, as I mean, I know from personal experience, when you're remarkably good looking, people don't take you as seriously as you might. And he had this Playboy image, but he did films, and we've actually talked about one of them in a previous podcast, Bulworth, but there are others that we could talk about in the future that actually tackle really directly political issues in a serious way, but also in a humorous way, because of course he's trying to find an audience. And unlike the mean faced kind of lemon squeezy kind of hardline Marxist figure that we associate with political drama, I'm thinking of Ken Loach, obviously. This is someone who is able to do things in a very popular way, and actually get a relatively complicated political message across as well. And because one of the things I liked in the film is the running gag, because that's what it is, which kind of underscores his relationship with Louise, Jack's relationship with Louise, where he, you know, it's always, Jack, your taxi's waiting. So taking him off away from her and abandoning the relationship for a while, during which time he will be having various little dalliances, of course. So, but it also doesn't like obfuscate, or there's a lecturer word, obfuscate, I like using that word. It doesn't obfuscate the harsh realities of being a radical in the United States, certainly in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. And also trying to organise trade unions in the United States, you know, where trade union meetings would be broken up by the police completely illegally, and people would be beaten up. And people like Emma Goldman, I mean, you said she left for Russia. She was sent back. She was deported because she wasn't born in the United States. So any radical that they could find that hadn't actually been born in the United States, they kicked them out. So it was a very oppressive time. And the film also includes Gene Hackman. And, you know, it's actually full of these great Hollywood actors doing little roles, actually. Gene Hackman plays the editor of a weekly or a monthly journal. And he, at various points, just says to Jack Reed, you know, if only you were saying the right thing, if you weren't a communist, if you weren't against President Wilson, if you were saying the right things, we'd publish you. So the whole idea of censorship of the kind of radical views is brought out, and it's just plain. So although Warren Beatty is himself, he's a radical liberal, he's not a Marxist, he's not a communist himself, the film reveals what it was like to be on the far left at this time, and it was a difficult time. It clearly was. You were oppressed. So there's humour, but there's also, you know, blunt reality is brought out, and that's something that I think a lot of political drama doesn't really cover. It's far too, you know, certainly in the British case, it's too often po-faced. And life is full of humour. And I mean, I was slagging off Ken Loach a bit there. But when Ken Loach was working in conjunction with writers with some kind of humour, there was some humour. But his natural disposition is not to do that. And I think political drama needs to be nuanced in order to get a bigger audience, if nothing else.
Well, yeah, and also politics is nothing without the human beings who make it. And so politics have to represent all the sides of human nature. And that's what I think I love so much about Reds, is it's a human drama. Making the choice to put that relationship at the heart of it may have been a Hollywood choice, but it also does show that these are real people, and that real people with real passions are perfectly capable of deciding very sensibly to be communists, because that's what they believe is the best system of government for the world. And I think to have a film that was optimistic about communism in 1981, which is when this film came out, and then have it win 3 Oscars and be nominated for 9.
12
is extraordinary.
Yes.
12 noms and 3 wins. Mm-hmm. That's right. Sorry. And they do that not by making a straight-laced, this is exactly what happened, but by making this a film where the human passions are equal to the political passions and both are considered important. And I think that's so such a valid choice. And I think it's also, it really helps you to understand why people were so passionate and so enthused about the Russian Revolution. I think there's such a revisionist, because we know how badly wrong things went in Soviet Russia under Stalin, etc. There is a revisionist sense that nothing good can be taken from this. So to make this film post-Stalin, you know, during the Cold War, and actually say, well, hang on, there's a reason this happened. There's a reason this was important. There's a reason people were kicking back against first Tsarist Russia and then the interim revolutionary government. And I think that sense of optimism shouldn't be lost, because if we do, you just then have to assume that all is misery and that misery can't be overthrown. And okay, there is a lot of cockeyed optimism that is thrown at people, and revolutions need to be well managed and fought through. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a kernel of something really important there. And I think for me, what I took most from this film was a sense that that has been lost too much in too much of our political discussion. Our political discussion has narrowed so much that we don't test ourselves by thinking about what could come of the extremes.
Yeah, I think the nuance in the film is kind of remarkable. I mean, it's there is no easy kind of explanation as to why things were going wrong. I mean, Stalin doesn't ever appear, but it's not really quite clear why the revolution's going awry, which it clearly is. But it does emphasize all the difficulties that people who were trying to make the revolution faced, and it does mention at various points the fact that they were, you know, Russia was being invaded by white forces, including American troops as well. So, you know, it wasn't like they had an easy ride and it all went wrong because, you know, communism is an evil thing. It was a complicated, nuanced picture that it was giving. And like you say, this is kind of remarkable given that it was being produced just as the second Cold War was kind of coming into place. But it's true that it was very, had Warren Beatty not made a very successful, profitable film, Heaven Can Wait, a few years before, he likely wouldn't have been able to have the kind of clout that would have got this film made. That he was told, he would advise, don't do it. You know, what, no one's going to watch it. It's, who wants to see a film about American communists that isn't slagging off the Russian Revolution? You know, don't. So, but it was his kind of push, constant desire to do it, and the power that he had within Hollywood at that time that got the film done. And that did mean that there were compromises, I think. I mean, maybe that's why there was so much romance about it. Although the romance is politicized. It's not just Hearts and Flowers. There are real issues that are going on in this relationship between these two people. But there were tensions, apparently. I mean, we will tweet this really good Vanity Fair article about the making of Reds. But there were tensions between Trevor Griffiths, the British Marxist playwright, who'd had, you know, National Theatre success and Play for Today success, and Warren Beatty, the Hollywood figure. And that, I think that tension was along the lines of what you were saying, you know, that Griffiths wanted it to be slightly more didactic, more about the politics, more words, more speeches, and Beatty wanted things to be more, more bullets, more nice views, dramatic scenes, and emotion, and actually maybe, you know, Beatty on his own wouldn't have produced the kind of film that Reds was, and Trevor Griffiths on his own would certainly not have produced the kind of film that Reds was. So that tension between those two different kind of approaches might have been the basis for the success.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. They sort of brought out the best in each other, as did Louise Bryant and Jack Reed.
Oh, nice glib parallel there. Very good.
I mean, what was interesting was that sometimes people in the film brought out the best in each other, but there was also a lot of infighting. And that's quite well demonstrated, particularly in the American communist scene. You have a lot of splitting of the Communist Party. You have the fact that they backed Woodrow Wilson, who then having promised to not put America in the war, then reneged on that promise, the First World War. And then the split between the Paul Sorvino-led Communist Party and the Warren Beatty-led Communist Party, which had different names, but I can't remember exactly what they were, which
Yeah, it's
and it's that, of course, that leads Warren Beatty to rush off to Russia for his third and final time, to try and get his own faction to be the internationally recognised one, very much against the wishes of his wife, Louise Bryant. And maybe we can hear a little bit about her objections now.
And if you go, I'm not sure I'll be here when you get back.
Louise, you know, the Comintern doesn't know Edmund or Alfred from the New York Yankees. They know me. Somebody's got to go over there who's got a background. We'd be back by Christmas. We can't merge with Farina. We can't deal with him on membership eligibility. He wouldn't accept half our people. The man is going to do nothing but alienate himself from any potential broad base of support. He's sociologically isolated. Programmatically, he's impossible
to deal with. You mean he's a foreigner?
Don't do that, Louise.
6 months ago, you were friends.
These people can barely speak English. They don't even want to be integrated into American life. The foreign language federations aren't going to create Bolshevism in America any more than eating borscht will. Being Russian doesn't make a revolution. Do you think the American worker is going to be led by the Russian federations or an insular Italian like Louis Freyna? He has no possibility of leading a revolution in this country.
Unlike you?
I'm just saying that the revolution in this country is not going to be led by immigrants.
Revolution in this country? When, Jack? Just after Christmas?
Well, what do you think we could have done with a steel strike if we'd been ready? 30,000 party members all armed with a unified theory and program, leading 365,000 steel workers. What it takes is leadership, and we got to get it by getting recognition from Moscow. I have to go.
You don't have to go. You want to go. You want to go running all over the world, ranting and raving and making resolutions and organizing caucuses. What's the difference between the Communist Party and the Communist Labor Party, except that you're running one and he's running the other?
I've made a commitment.
To what? To the fine distinction between which half of the left is recognized by Moscow as the real Communist Party in America? To petty political squabbling between humorless and hack politicians just wasting their time on left-wing dogma? To getting the endorsement of a committee in Russia you call the International for your group of 14 intellectual friends in the basement who are supposed to tell the workers of this country what they want, whether they want it or not? Right, Jack. You're not a politician, you're a writer. Your writing has done more for the revolution than 20 years of this infighting could do, and you know it. You're an artist, Jack. Don't go. Don't run away from what you do the best.
I'll be back by Christmas.
Yeah, I think that scene, or at least that part of the film where there's different factions with, you know, frankly, very little between them, but some very acute point of ideology that divides them, kind of does. It's a bit like that, you know, the People's Front of Judea and the Judean People's Front. I mean, it was kind of like that. That is,
I mean, I was trying very hard to work out why it mattered so much that he put his health at risk. I mean, he knew his health wasn't good, but it mattered so much that he go and that it be his faction. And I was just, I mean, you probably had to be in the faction to get what the incredibly vital differences were. But I'm not sure, deliberately or not, whether the film explained them that well. And maybe it didn't deliberately. Maybe it was making my point for me.
But it was important, whatever the precise differences were, and yeah, you're absolutely right, it wasn't very made clear, because I guess at that point they would have to spend about 50 minutes explaining the kind of niceties of Marxist ideology at that point. But and we all want that, don't we? But it was important to him that his party got the endorsement of the Comintern. And that was important because at that moment he was still looking at the Russian Revolution as this great hope for humanity. So of course it was important that the Comintern endorses his faction. But then we get this, like I said right at the start, you know, must be a unique Hollywood moment where the discussions of the Comintern are shown and dramatized. And so quite a bit of the film is him trying to persuade the Comintern that his faction should get endorsed and failing. And it's clear that the Comintern doesn't want to understand. It's already made a decision which is based on completely nothing. And his faction has not been the one that's endorsed. And
Well, it doesn't seem to be based on completely nothing. Well, the sense I got from the Comintern was stop squabbling, children. Get all together. We just want one of you. Sort it out.
That's true. The Comintern did in fact want them to sort of come together. But it was just an authoritarian, just this, you have to do this. So it's kind of, I don't know that the film was really making very much of that. But of course, there are people that talk about individual communist parties in different countries being told what to do by the Comintern, and that's a bad thing. Because as we know, Stalin in the end completely misread the situation in many countries and told the various communist parties to do the wrong thing. I don't know if that was a criticism or it was just, it demonstrated the confusion, I think. Because when Beattie was trying to explain his case to a group of people who for whom English was by no means their first or indeed only any language, and the way things were being translated from one to another to another language, and it did bring out, I thought, in at least in that respect, the complete confusion of the early days of communism as a system, as an attempt to kind of replace capitalism. It was kind of tragicomic, really.
Yeah, I think there is, they completely invented a new system and a new way of doing things and then threw themselves into doing it in an absolutely ginormous country in 10 days, as we know from the book. And I think there are real tensions between, the ongoing, capitalism has developed over many, many, many years. Socialism, communism have developed as a response to that, but have not really been, they're still quite in their infancy compared to capitalism. So I think this kind of document where there's a sense of that infancy, which carries in it both a note of pessimism that we do know that there will be authoritarian tendencies. There is a question to be asked about whether communism always leads to authoritarianism. But there's also a huge amount of optimism. And in the end, spoiler alert again, Jack's optimism kills him. It's his belief that he can, keep going and keep doing these things that ends up with him dying age 33 in Moscow. But he also lived for that optimism. And he is an exuberant. I think there's a lovely sort of parallel between him and the dog that they get. They're as puppyish as each other. He's an exuberant person. He lives a fabulous, exuberant life. And he does that because of this set of beliefs that he has. And then there is a real sense that sometimes he's putting his political beliefs over his personal life, but it's not as easy to unpick as all that.
And for a film in which the central protagonist or one of the two central protagonists dies, and actually having said that, I'm now recognising in Warren Beatty's films that often is the case. The central protagonist that he plays often dies. I don't need to go through the list, but they do.
Don't, because we haven't done some of them yet, and I haven't watched some of them yet. So.
Okay. Well, we know that Bulworth, he dies.
We know that they're well, it's questions.
Yeah. Right. Anyway. That for a film in which one of the central figures dies, it's a very hopeful film. It's a film which is full of optimism. It's not crazy-eyed optimism, but it's a hopeful film. And I think that's kind of underscored by having all of these, old crumbly, figures who must have been in their 80s or their 90s when they were being interviewed, recalling their own youths and their own pasts. And that
one of them, straight after the intermission, one starts singing the Internationale. I was actually born to the tune of the Internationale. They used to encourage women in labour to sing, and so my mum sang the Red Flag and the Internationale while I was being born. So it's a song that I've known literally my whole life. Although when I was a little girl, I did used to get starvelings and starlings confused. So I did the first line of the Internationale is "Arise, ye starvelings, from your slumbers," and I had this image of people marching in their revolutionary boots and waking up all the birds in Red Square. That was what I thought that line meant until I was about 20. But it's just, Again, it's that human thing. And because they're real, you just think, you can see when she's singing the Internationale that it still means so much to her. And you just think, yes, it's so rare to see a representation of someone feeling that way about communism. And okay, I'm not a revolutionary. I'm an evolutionary socialist. But still, I so rarely get that sense portrayed back at me from pieces of art like this, that it, and to have it done in such a way that was so accepted by the Hollywood mainstream, that was a commercial success, that was an artistic success. I think, you know, hats off to Warren Beatty. And I think, as you said earlier, you know, he is gorgeous, and maybe that isn't why he gets the credit he absolutely deserves.
And on that bombshell, I think we should bring this podcast to an end. And it is my responsibility to invite our listener to rate us on iTunes. Please, listener, do that so that people get to see us in all our glory, and that people know what you think about what we're doing. To thank Lord Stuart Wood for our little theme tune, and to remind everybody that this is a political human production.